Creating the internet.
Our signal's always clear. Internet radio, streaming live 24 hours a day.
Hi, Barry McGuire here, inviting you to come along with Marla Brooks and let's start stirring the cauldron together on Para X.
Stirring your source for everything paranormal. Para X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Meet everybody and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron here on the Para X Radio Network. Tonight we're going to talk about a topic that most people have heard about, but I think some may not understand the enormity of the situation and the backlash on many levels that the pagan community, as well as many others, still fight on a daily basis. The topic for tonight's show dates back to 1692 when two young girls caused mass hysteria in Salem, Massachusetts, by making up a story and condemning innocent people in a society that was already driven by superstition and fear. From the 14th to the 18th century, all over Europe, thousands upon thousands of alleged witches were falsely accused and then burned to death or hanged. By the late 1600s, America was tainted as well. The Salem witch hysteria of 1692 became one of the most tragic events in American history. And Stacy Tilney, the Director of Communications at the Salem Witch Museum in Salem, Massachusetts, is here to talk about the museum and the trials. So, Stacy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, most people know about the Salem Witch Trials. They've heard stories, they've seen movies, read books like The Crucible. But I think many just take the information as a part of history, like learning about the Alamo or the Pilgrims Landing at Plymouth Rock. But there's so much more to the Burning Times and the Witch Trials than just a page in history. So let's start out by you giving us a little background on the museum itself, which happens to be the most visited museum in Salem.
Especially this time of year. We're getting into our summer months, and it's especially busy this time. But The museum was originally put together as the Salem Witch Museum in 1972. What I think is the most incredible part is the look of the building that we're in. We're very fortunate that we have this gorgeous old church. Mm-hmm. The original structure was built in 1840s, 1845 and 1846, and it's done in the old Gothic style, so it has the crenellated arches and the triforium window, so it's a really special-looking building that was used as a church. It was used as a Unitarian church until about the World War II, and has suffered a couple of fires, turned into an auto museum, strangely enough. And then in 1972, we took it over and turned it into the Salem Witch Museum.
Wow. So, you know, I think sometimes if people look and see Salem Witch Museum, they may think that it's like some of the other witch museum, which have artifacts and, you know, witch mirrors and torture devices and all that stuff. So maybe we should talk about what is inside, what the displays are, what your motivation for having that museum is all about.
Sure. We do our presentation in two parts, the first of which really focuses on the witch trial history that you mentioned from 1692. That was a part of our colonial past, as you mentioned, very tragic. But we also do a second exhibit that looks at the origins of the idea of witches in pre-Christian times, how the perceptions of people, pagans especially, changed through history, as you mentioned, in the 1400s especially, and how that perception led to what Puritans were thinking about when this outbreak took place in 1692. And we don't even stop there. We bring it right into our modern context, because as we know, unfortunately, still witch hunts happen all the time all over the world.
Yeah, and they're not all about witches, which is kind of nice in a sense, you know, because you know how we always get blamed for everything.
Right.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about the trials themselves?
Probably that the accused witches may have been, in fact, witches. Mm-hmm. At least by and large, were Puritans, and Puritan Christianity was a part of the church. It was an escape from the Church of England, but they were monotheists. Mm-hmm. So that would be one misconception, and the other one would be that there were victims burned here in the United States, and that happened only in Europe. So those are the two main misconceptions.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those who may not know, how did the hysteria begin?
A lot of the traditional storytelling starts with, as you mentioned, the two young girls who began to exhibit strange behavior. Abigail Williams and Betty Paris lived in the same home. It was Betty Paris's father, Reverend Paris, and Abigail Williams was a cousin, or the niece of Reverend Paris. And the story goes that probably Tituba, who was the house servant, may have been telling stories, and that the two young girls were spurned by that. They were perhaps doing some fortune telling, which was not shouldn't have been done by Puritan standards. They didn't really appreciate that kind of thing. So perhaps these young girls were doing this idle game to try to divine who their husbands would be. What young girl hasn't done that? Mm-hmm. So they probably got caught, and in an effort to, deflect blame, they exhibited these strange behaviors, including barking, strange fits, physical reactions, bending, tongues lolling out, throwing Bibles against the wall, this kind of behavior that would certainly not be considered typical.
Especially in a reverend's house.
Oh, especially, right. So these two girls kind of get the ball rolling, and no one can quite figure out what's wrong with them, although there had been many precedents before that of people acting this way, and the assumption was that they had been bewitched. Mm-hmm. But they did take it the one step further, and they did call in a physical doctor. And he came in, Dr. Griggs, to look at the girls and just double check to make sure. Maybe he could think of some physical reason that was causing this behavior. But he couldn't find anything, so naturally, I say with irony, he assumed they were bewitched. They had been afflicted by witches. So that's where most of the time the story of the witch trials starts. And I say that because, from my point of view, the most interesting part of the story occurs well before anyone exhibits strange behavior. But we'll get into that later if you want to.
Okay. I think it might be interesting to talk a little bit about what the politics and beliefs of the people of Salem were at that time. I mean, we know that they were Puritans by religion, but I also read that they weren't a very happy little community. It was sort of a community divided and about to split itself in two.
That's really true, and that's exactly what it, precisely for this reason. There were political undertones taking place here, and if I can bring you back to when the Puritans and the Pilgrims before them left England, they left the Church of England, they didn't agree espousing at the time, so they came to the New World to practice freedom of religion. Now, I want to just be clear about this. They wanted freedom to practice their own religion, not necessarily freedom for everyone to practice their religions, but in any case, they come over to this New World hoping to find their paradise on a hill, so to speak, to create their own paradise community. And, you know, to dubious ends. I mean, it was a wilderness, and there was wars between England and France, and they brought in the Indian population. That's what they were called at the time. Of course, we call them Native Americans today. But there were all sorts of political and warlike undertones to set the stage. Mm-hmm. In Salem Village and Salem Town, it's two different towns today, but at the time they were one large community. Mm-hmm. In Salem Town, which is where I address you from at the moment, we're a seaside harbor town. And at this time, in 1692, we're starting to become more advanced, a little more sophisticated, you might say. Mm-hmm. Ships are going abroad. They're bringing back spices and silks from the Orient. And it's very exotic. And so the wealth is starting to grow in Salem Town. Mm-hmm. In Salem Village, just northwest of here, is a very pastoral community. A lot of farming is going on here in 1692. And up until this point, farming was really the way to make your living. But now things are starting to change. And as Salem Town becomes more wealthy, people from the pastoral community of Salem Village feel that when they go to meetings on Sunday, in other words, when they go to church on Sunday, their needs and their interests are not being addressed by the Salem Town Church. So they decide that they would like to have their own church, their own meeting house. So they build a meeting house in Salem Village and attempt to hire a minister for this parish. And he lasts a couple of years. It doesn't come to fruition. There is back and forth fighting over whether or not this minister should be paid, who should belong to this new church. So he quickly leaves, and the next minister comes along. And he, too, is met with debate between people who are for his ministry and people who are against his ministry. And this goes on for several years until we get to Reverend Paris. Samuel Paris is... you know, his father is a wealthy man, and he is the younger of two brothers. So when his father passes away, he is left with the lesser of the entitlements, including a plantation in Barbados. So he goes there and tries his hand at that, and he's not a very successful merchant, so he decides to come to Massachusetts and become a minister. And he lands in Salem Village, the fourth in a series, was controversial. So he attempts to negotiate his, you know, his contract, if you will, and they kind of go forward. But still, this factionalism between people who want to have this meeting house and people who do not want the meeting house to be independent, this rages on.
And things start turning a little sour. So everybody's kind of up in arms to begin with, you know. It just doesn't start out easily.
Right, exactly. There's angst. There are a lot
fear.
There's fear that's brewing, no pun intended. And this is the environment in which the young girls live. They are, you know, hanging around while they hear the adults talking about this neighbor or that neighbor who is giving them a hard time. And so if you fast forward to the early winter of 1692, when these girls are caught playing this game, and they are forced to now name names for who is bewitching them, who do you think they accuse? But the enemies, whose names they've heard readily in their own household.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, you know, a very common thing, but what turned into, you know, listening to your parents and picking up on the tone of the time turned into something that was, like I said before, a terrible atrocity. And so there were 19 people. Well, all right, let me ask you this. How many people were falsely accused and how many were actually put to death?
There were about 150 total accused, and that extended out to Essex County at large. So it didn't just happen here in Salem, but the surrounding communities had people who were accused there as well. So the towns of Andover and Salisbury and Ipswich and Topsfield, they all had citizens that were accused. Uh-huh. The trials and the questioning did take place in Salem. And so there were about 150 accused, 19 were hanged, and one man, Giles Corey, was pressed to death.
Uh-huh. Yeah, his famous quote is out there quite a bit. More weight, exactly. You know, I think, though, it was a bit convoluted that those who admitted to being witches were spared, while, in fact, you know, the ones that were lying to save, I mean, they were lying to save their necks, and those who told the truth about not being witches were hung. I mean,
that's
that
right.
Just makes no sense at all.
That is the irony of the story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, during the trials, what criteria was used to determine guilt, or was it all hearsay and one person ratting another out for no good reason? Because we know in Europe with the Malleus Maleficarum, I mean, that was more or less the judge and jury on who was and wasn't a witch. I mean, it was all written down there, if you do this and this and this and this and this.
Sure. And those traditions definitely extended to Salem in 1692. They were still using the test of trying to find markings on the body, witches' teats that they believed were the place where the devil nourished himself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, bodily examinations were certainly done. Mm-hmm. But you're right to say that a lot of it was hearsay. It was these young girls claiming that they saw things. And the official term is spectral evidence. This is that they claim to see the ghosts or the apparitions of the supposed witches flying around, or they would see the apparitions of familiars, like mm-hmm. birds. They would see birds suckling on the fingers of the supposed witches. Mm-hmm. And based on that testimony, as you know, the victims were convicted.
Right. And I was going to mention spectral evidence to beginning because it played a very big part, at least in the beginning. But even so, hearing the fake testimony of the two girls was enough really to get the ball rolling. And that in of itself is rather shocking.
Sure.
You know,
especially
if it's so credible.
Right. Especially at this time when, by Puritan standards, young women did not have a voice. Who's to say whether they would have been listened to had they said something that didn't really play into the political agenda of the adults? Mm-hmm. I mean, these young girls were saying exactly what the adults subconsciously wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm. And kids do. I mean, they pick up on, you know, what they hear in the town or whatever. I mean, because we all as children think our parents are, you know, always
know
right.
Everything.
And yeah. And so, of course, you know, then we try to stick up for them and we copycat for good or bad, how they are. But I read where the spectral evidence at some point just kind of got dropped.
Well, there were definitely people of authority, ministers and magistrates alike, who did not feel that spectral evidence was a reliable way to determine whether someone was a witch. They believed fully in witches. They believed that in all likelihood those who had been accused were guilty of their crimes, but they stopped, some of them of course, stopped at feeling that spectral evidence was a credible, meaningful way to determine whether someone was a witch. So that's why, fortunately, it did ultimately stop. But if it had not been for spectral evidence, no one would have lost their lives because there was no other physical evidence.
Well, I also read where one test of a witch was their inability, or their, their inability to recite the Lord's Prayer without making mistake. And still, one of the men who was hanged, George Burroughs, recited the Lord's Prayer flawlessly, but, you know, even that did not save him. I mean, they were on a mission. It didn't matter, I think.
Oh, the Puritans contradict themselves all the time in this story, and that is a really good example of that. They were schizophrenic. they really wanted their man, so, you know, this would be, they would make the exception. Oh, well, you know, he did say the Lord's Prayer properly, but we know he's a witch, so.
Yeah, the devil probably let him say it properly, just to fool them. Yeah, I mean, there's always someone to pass the blame on to.
Well, and here's my question. You know, let's just play the game for a minute and say that we believe that these people were witches. Let's just play this game for a second. So in the Puritan mind, God is almighty. So is it God's decision to allow the devil to exist? So you see what I'm getting at? God's God is allowing all of this to happen, if you believe by the Puritan standard. The devil, really, if you were, if you believe in that sort of thing, that that he couldn't really overtake a person.
Exactly. But, you know, there was also the fact that, you know, women, and obviously there were some men that were hanged, but the majority were women. But as you said earlier, women did not have a place or a voice. And the whole thing when Christianity came into play and they started converting people over to Christianity from paganism was make the woman a hussy, make the woman a whore, make the woman the one who, you know, will grab those men and do all kinds of bad things to them because, you know, they signed the devil's guest book or something. And so that just, you know, it makes it all the more. Now, I don't know what they were thinking when they convicted men at this point.
All of the men were affiliated with women who were accused of being witches. It was considered a family tradition. These were things that were passed along from mother to daughter. And men who were accused were always, at least in the Salem witch trials, always affiliated with women who were accused. So the men were perhaps the husband of an accused witch or the father or the son of an accused witch.
Yeah, someone that was standing up for them, knowing that they were innocent. And, you know, I always joke and say that if any of them had been witches, they probably would not have gotten caught, you know, or
something.
But, and, you know, when you think of the burning times and the numbers, particularly in Europe, you have to figure by just by rote, you know, there were some witches that were actually caught. But, I mean, that's still an injustice because it's still kind of infringing on a religious freedom, but back in those days, you either did it their way or you didn't do it at all.
Absolutely.
So, you know, somebody that worshipped slugs or something would have just been as bad off. Now, surely the people of Salem knew of the burning times in Europe. Is there any explanation that you know of as to why they chose hanging in Salem rather than burning? Did they think perhaps it was more humane or was rope cheaper than wood? Or I don't know.
That's a great question. by the time we get to 1692 in the colonies, societies are changing enough from religious governments to secularized governments, which for sure played into the angst. So those people who believed that leaders should be not only leaders of government, but they should be leaders of the church, had very different ideas from people who felt that, societies should be led in a secularized way. And the punishment in Europe, in the old world, for the religious crime of being a witch was burning at the stake. Here in the colonies, as we become a more secularized society, the crime of being a witch is a capital crime, obviously, one that you lose your life for, but in the same line as, let's say, murder, a secular crime punishable by hanging. So it was really just a matter of that it was seen more as a non-religious crime at this point.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've got a question from the chat room from Nyla, and I do have a part answer to this, and maybe you have the rest of it, but she was asking if there is any known revenge curses on the descendants of those girl accusers or any bad things happening to descendants. And I just had to come, I happened to come across something yesterday that one of the condemned got a very, one of the guys that did the condemning really got a kind of a witchy revenge, although it could have been karma. Because at the hangings, Reverend Nicholas Noyes asked Sarah Good to confess, and she said, "I am no more a witch than you are a wizard, and if you take away my life, God will give you blood to drink." And 25 years later, the Reverend, the good Reverend, died of a hemorrhage choking on his own blood.
Right.
Now, you know, most people say, she did it. You know, I'm not so sure that's the case. I kind of like to think that karma stepped in, but do you have any other examples of that?
You took my good one. That's the one I know for sure happened. The other stories that I've heard, I think, are more legend, you know, that subsequent sheriffs may have died of heart attacks or other afflictions.
Now that one I've heard, yes.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to be the sheriff of Salem.
Right, exactly. But the Nicholas Noyes example is one that that is documented.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, well, you would think, and it just seems that in the things we read and the things we see in the reenactions of what happened there that we see, it seems like most of them all went with good grace. Now, you don't know what happened because we weren't there,
right,
but it just seems like they resigned themselves to the fact that they were going to die. You didn't see any kicking and screaming and, acting out. And you have to think, how would you feel in that situation? I don't know if I could sit there and just take it and say, okay, well, I leave it to God. I just don't know.
What a great point. Yeah, especially when you consider that what we know about the trials is based on accounts that were made by men in power, because they were the ones who tended to write, keep journals or keep diaries of what was going on. And they were also the ones who would take the trial transcripts. And these were typically not friendlies to the accused witches. They were the people who did the transcription, the reverends themselves or magistrates themselves who were in the company of those accused during the hangings, they were the ones who described these situations. And when you think about the fact that they described the dignity, unintentionally maybe, but they themselves described the dignity that the victims suffered or that they displayed during their suffering.
Yeah, it's almost amazing. I mean, the only one, and people are talking about this in the chat room right now, the only one who was rather defiant was Giles Corey. And for those who don't know his story, do you want to fill them in?
So Giles was accused of being a witch. He first accused his own wife of being a witch. She read a lot of books. Yeah, she read a lot of books, and he was later accused of being a witch, and because of the laws at the time, if you were convicted of being a witch, you could lose your movable property. You couldn't lose your land, but your movable property would go into the hands of of the town, and it would go towards paying your prison and your food and so on. So rather than subject his family to that loss, should he be convicted, he just didn't acknowledge the court at all. He simply would not enter a plea. And so in order to force him to enter a plea, they used this medieval torture of lying him prostrate, putting a board on his chest, and successively putting heavier and heavier stones on his chest, which is where we get the expression "more weight," because the judge would say, "Well, you know, what do you have to say today?" And he'd say, "More weight. You know, I'm still not playing your game. Put on the rocks."
Yeah. And so amazingly, amazingly, it took 2 days or more for him to.
2 or 3 days.
Which is incredible to suffer that agony that long, but it shows that he had a great deal of conviction.
Yeah, well, and they used that against him, too. They figured, well, if he was that strong, he must surely be a witch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and somebody, I'm just noticing in chat room, said that he cursed the town. Was he the one that might have given the curse about the sheriffs? Or
that's possible, you know? Yeah. I think I've heard that legend.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, he wanted it that way, so I mean, you know, but still, it's one of those things where he was just making a statement.
Right.
Yeah. Now,
indeed he did.
He did, and left a very, because I think of all of those who were put to death in 1692 in Salem, he is the one that stands out, I think, as, and I guess maybe some people think it's grisly, you know, in a horrible way to die and everything, but he's the one I think people remember most just because of his convictions. And in that sense, that's a good thing. Now, I've got another question from the chat room, and I was actually going to bring this up myself. Sandy wants to know what you think about the ergot theory of what was going on then.
That's a great question. In the 70s, there had been some scientists who looked into the cereal grain that they were using for their breads in 1692, rye and wheats, were susceptible during particularly wet weather, as it was in late 1691 and early 1692. It was a very wet winter, and the grain was susceptible to accumulating a mold, a fungus, called ergot. And ergot could manifest itself in a couple of ways, one of which was these sort of convulsive, what we would liken to LSD hallucinations. Mm-hmm. And so that seemed like a very neat explanation. But if you look very closely at the symptoms that were manifest, they aren't exactly like ergot. Mm-hmm. It's close, but not quite. If you were a biologist, you could probably make those distinctions a little bit more adroitly than I can at the moment, but they're not quite exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, you could turn off and on these symptoms, or these girls did anyway, evidently.
Yeah.
1 minute they would be quite calm, and then a witch would be addressed, a supposed witch would be accused, or in the case of, let's say, Rebecca Nurse, who was the first time she was acquitted, and as soon as the girls heard that she was considered innocent, they erupt in convulsions. And it's our view that, you know, if they were really suffering from this kind of an illness, you wouldn't be able to turn it off and on. You'd be really sick, and you wouldn't have a lot of control over that.
Yeah.
So you kind of see how it's developing into an act. Probably psychological. I'm sure, you know, on some level these young girls believed their own stories. So I don't know that I could say that they were, in the most literal sense, lying. But they were not suffering, in my opinion, any sort of biological illness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, you read 10 different articles about it, and you get 10 different answers. And I think one of the things that in one article that I read said, well, how coincidental was it that the next year when the fungus died and the crops were okay, the trials ended abruptly. So, you know, again, it's kind of hearsay and something we may never know.
That, well, that is a fact, Marla. We will never know. But what I like about it is that people are asking and they're thinking and they're wondering and they're curious. I love all of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit, because I just mentioned the trials ending rather abruptly, because I know one of the misconceptions that people have heard is that they went on for years and years, and it was actually just, you know, several months.
Right.
But they did all of a sudden just go away. And what I was reading was that, conscience hit a lot of people, lack of firm evidence hit a lot of people, guilt. What was it, in your opinion, what was the reason that all of a sudden, poof, we're sorry, oops, we made a mistake?
Yeah. I think everything you just mentioned really plays a part. Some people even throw in the notion that as long as it was poor people, it was fine. But once you started to accuse people who were of material substance or political clout, oh, now it's getting uncomfortable. You know, and when William Phipps' family is being affected, he was the governor at the time. When his family begins to be accused, well, you can be sure that he's going to really try to put this thing to a halt.
And interestingly enough, it took, what, 300 years for Salem to, what, put up a plaque and do a ceremony or something and apologize in public or what?
Right. Well, in 1711, there was a reversal of attainder, which means that the rights were given back to the executed. When they were executed, when they were convicted of being witches, their rights were taken away. In 1711, so many years after the trials, after there was remorse expressed and there were apologies made, most but not all of the accused and executed had been given back their rights. Well,
Exactly, right.
but a few of the victims' families, maybe they moved away, or for whatever reason, simply did not petition the courts to have the names cleared. So fast forward to the 20th century, and there was a professor from Salem State, it was Salem State College at the time, it's now Salem State University, who noticed that these few names had not been cleared yet, so she petitioned and was granted that these names be cleared. So Jane Swift, our governor during that time, did make an official exoneration of all of the accused. So there were a few names that just had to be cleared at the end there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 300 years later.
Yeah. Well, you know, better late than never, isn't that
better late than never, right.
All right, I want to talk a little bit about your new exhibit. It's called Witches Evolving Perceptions, because with all the bad press that the pagan community still has to contend with, I'm sometimes inclined to believe that the perceptions are still revolving rather than evolving.
I would say that I could understand why you would feel that way. I'm not sure. Salem is just a really different community, though, and we have, there's not a way to count, of course, but we suspect that we have about twice the national average of practicing Wiccans here in Salem, and have a very tolerant community. So I think you'd probably find people who still experience that kind of, you know, a struggle. But in Salem, it's a little bit different.
Right. Just right. Everywhere else in the world, we're still living down the bad press of hundreds and hundreds of years.
Sure.
And, but tell us a little bit about the exhibit.
Okay. We begin by talking about the origin story of the witch. Before she's even called a witch, she's probably called a wise woman. Mm-hmm. Right. She's probably called... you know, in our vernacular, we'd call her a midwife, someone who's a healer and can use herbs. So she would have started out as a revered figure in her community. And because she lived in the country and because she practiced these quote unquote strange religious or traditions, by Christian standards, once you get into the Middle Ages, you have this clash of belief systems, monotheisms versus polytheisms. So this once revered midwife with her powers to cure is now vilified because if she practices this crazy religion, well, she must be in cahoots with the devil. Well, that can only make sense, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea was the same powers that she used to help her own community heal were supposed to be now her instruments of diabolism. Now she can use those potions and spells to curse and harm her enemies. Mm-hmm. So we talk about that sort of early negative stereotyping, and we follow it into talking about the Book of Exodus that describes witches as sorceresses who should not be allowed to live, that they have entered into a covenant with the devil, and because of that relationship should not even be allowed the liberty of life. And these culture clashes go on. And most people are familiar with the story of Joan of Arc and how she was burned at the stake. Mm-hmm. We go on to talk about the Malleus Maleficarum and codifying the hunting of witches based on physical attributes and all these horrible things she supposedly did, you know, flying into the night, stealing men's body parts, you know, incubuses and succubuses and all sorts of... I mean, you were talking about the sexualized aspect, and that is certainly true. Think about the Adam and Eve story. She was the temptress, right? Women are the downfall of man, right?
So
we
they
can't
say.
Be trusted. You know, we can't control our passions, you know, and men can't control themselves around us, so they should be afraid of us. Yes. So we talk a little bit about that. And we also kind of draw this English tradition of witches and how they were dealt with into the colonial side of things, how people were treated here in Salem during the early 17th century. And then we bring it right into the present day and we talk about how, you know, witch hunts happen, that they're happening today. You could probably pick up a newspaper anywhere and find examples of witch hunts that are going on somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, what I was going to say, that the term witch hunt came from the burning times, but it's still used today. And in your exhibits, some of the current witch hunts are used as an example of the stereotyping and prejudice that not only witches have to deal with, but lots of other groups of people as well. What are some of the current examples that you talk about?
Well, it might not be totally current. I'll get there in a second, but I want to point out the instance where Arthur Miller writes about the Crucible. Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of people associate that time. We're all familiar with the Crucible. We're all familiar with in the 1950s when the House Un-American Activities Committee was trying to ferret out supposed communists. And, you know, I'm sure there were communists in this country at the time. But the problem was that if you had ever spoken to a communist, if you'd ever been to a socialism meeting in college, or, you know, your best friend's brother's sister's hairdresser's dog walker once, you know, went to a rally, you could be brought for questioning. Right. And if that happened, there were a couple of ways that it could go. You could... you know, rat out your friends and save your skin, which is very much how the witch trials of Salem in 1692 worked. If you could point out other witches, you might mitigate your circumstances. Mm-hmm. And likewise, in the 1950s, if you would roll on your brother because you claimed he was a communist, well, that might help save your skin. Mm-hmm. So a lot of filmmakers, screenwriters were blacklisted. and Arthur Miller was brought to question, and when he was, he wrote The Crucible as an analogy for what he was going through at the time. So that's an example from the 1950s. We talk about in the 1980s, during the outbreak of AIDS, that we didn't really understand exactly how AIDS was transmitted, but certainly people with a social agenda felt like this was a great opportunity to persecute the gay community. But as we know today, you certainly do not need to be gay to contract AIDS or to spread it. So we could even get into something way more modern. We could talk about 9/11 and the way people of Middle Eastern descent are treated, perhaps especially in the Northeast. We could even go as close as this year with the way immigrants are treated in an economy that is very short of jobs. So, I mean, it happens even on January or June 30th, 2011.
Yeah, I mean, it's guilt by association. It's intolerance from one to the next. I mean, this is something that humanity has lived with all their lives, you know, ever since the beginning of time. And it's very, very difficult. I mean, yeah, it's easy. I always make a joke about, witches get blamed for everything. And maybe that's just because, you know, people hear more about it. But witch hunts are all over, the intolerance, the disrespect, and the fact of being guilty by association. And that played very much in the trials.
Well, the societies and the human psyche need scapegoats for what is ailing our society. You know, we need someone to blame. And once we blame and persecute that person or group of people, we feel vindicated. So I think it's very natural and human for us to do that. You know, but here's the challenge is looking inside ourselves, because I would want to say to you, Marla, right now that, of course I'm open-minded, and of course I would never judge someone, but if I were really to be honest, I'd have to say that there has to be images in my own heart and mind that I'm not even aware of that play into the way I treat people without even my knowing. And that's the challenge, is, you know, examining your own behavior and the way you treat people.
It's understanding and education, I think, and that's why this exhibit, in many ways, is a very good thing, because a lot of people, I always say, live in the black and white, but it's okay to do that, but we need to live in the gray as well. We need at least to be open-minded. If you hear something that you don't like, you don't have to like it, but at least listen. It goes back to the tolerance. It goes back to the prejudices and everything. And I think closed-mindedness and that stubborn hanging on to certain things makes it very difficult. And again, that's, I guess, where the scapegoats come in.
It's true.
So, you know, it's a very... I mean, this whole thing is a very difficult topic to discuss because, you know, on some levels, pagans are like, still really ticked off, to put it mildly. But it just, you know, we, as you and I were talking on the phone the other day, it's just more than that. You know, it just, it's not that cut and dried. It has to do with humanity. And good and bad and all over the place. So, I mean, this is why I think it was really important to talk about this and let it be known that it wasn't just about pagans. It just, it spills over to everybody. And sometimes I think we have to step back and think a little bit and maybe at least open our minds to be willing to listen, to be willing to maybe try and understand. You know, nobody expects everybody to do a full 360 and
right.
You know, the whole world is not going to get along no matter what you do. There's always going to be issues, but I just think tolerance and patience and education is the key, and that's why I think the museum is so important, because it opens a lot of eyes to a lot of different things. We are rapidly running out of time, but what do you feel I mean, in discussing this, especially about the trials and everything, what's the lesson learned here in your opinion?
I wish you hadn't said it so eloquently for me. I think it's about tolerance. And the thing is that it's really easy to tolerate ideas that are, okay, maybe a little different than ours, but they're still in the same general area. Mm-hmm. It's the things that really, really revolt us that those are the ones that are a real challenge, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I can think of some extreme groups that I would like to say, well, I can't tolerate that. But they're just as entitled to have a voice and to have their own opinions as I am. It's hard sometimes, though. So
yeah,
I think the message is tolerance.
I think I kind of go by the Wiccan read in that, and that is, and ye harm none. Do as you will, and ye harm none.
I like that one a lot.
I want to give you an opportunity to tell our listeners where they can go to get more information on the museum. And, you know, hours and all that good stuff?
Sure. Online, we're at SalemWitchMuseum.com. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Salem Witch Muse. you can check out some videos on YouTube. And we're open from 10 a.m. until 7 p.m. for all of July and August. And then October, give us a call. We have a ton of extended hours, and there is no better, more fun place to hang out during the Halloween month than Salem, Massachusetts.
Oh, no kidding. Jeez, I'm jealous. I'm so far on the West Coast. It just annoys me. Wait, I need to figure out a spell to move Salem over here or to me, you know, to move over there. I haven't figured that out yet, but I'm working on it because it is a very magical place. And I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, and thank you for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure.
And I want to thank everybody who's listening in tonight, both in the Para-X chat room and elsewhere, because there's a lot of places to listen to Para-X. And if you want to hear the show again, you can go to Para-X On Demand at www.para-x.com. Just click on the On Demand tab and scroll down to STC. And while you're there, don't forget to have a peek at some of our other great shows. And, you know, we're a really friendly place, so people should just pop in the chat room and say hi and download some of the shows. Anyway, we better run. So, again, thank you, Stacy. And we're getting lots of nods in the chat room. They like you. This is good.
Thank you.
All right. So until next week, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more fun. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2009. You have been listening to the Para-X Radio Network.